Psalm 23. It's a song. The Psalms, right smack dab in the middle of your Bible, they make a bunch of statements about God, but they're not simply to be understood or appreciated as statements or doctrinal positions about God. They're songs. In their original language, they often rhyme. They have a certain meter to them, a certain cadence. They're recited together. They're sung, and for an Orthodox Hebrew person, they would know that there are melodies that these go to. That you can mention a psalm, and they say, "Oh, this one goes this way," and rather than it just being read, it actually is an artistic expression about God, about life, about us. And so we're going to be in Psalm or Song 23 for the next few weeks. And we've got some hopes for this series that we've been excited about for a while. And one of those would be that it would serve as a way of us getting to know God better. But one of the problems that many of us, we don't realize is a problem, but we're sitting here with this problem, is that we're too familiar with Psalm 23. Oh, I know that one. That's the Lord is my shepherd one. I know Psalm 23. Dallas Willard says that familiarity breeds unfamiliarity, and unfamiliarity breeds contempt, and that's profound. That you can get so used to something that you don't even notice it anymore. But have you ever been listening to the radio, and you hear a song that you've been listening to for 20 years, and it hits you different, and you go, "Hey, that song's about this," and then you can't ever hear it the old way again. It takes on a whole new meaning. I think there are a lot of things in life about that, not least of which would be the scriptures. And Psalm 23, we feel like it's a great example of that. We've been really excited about going through for the next few weeks this psalm, line by line. So our hope is that we would all grow in our faith, we grow in our understanding of God and of each other. One of our other hopes would be that we would all memorize it. It's six verses. A lot of us have already memorized Psalm 23, maybe as a child or part of some other kind of course or class that you went through in the faith. And some of you, you're like, I've never memorized scripture, and I don't know what the point is. Well, there's a bunch of reasons why you would do that. One of those would be when the pressure's on, whatever you've absorbed, when you squeeze it, that's what comes out. So some of you are like, "I don't know where that came from. Why did I say that?" It's because you've memorized that. It's part of your life. And so memorizing scripture is a way of getting at our core, light, life, truth. So when the pressure's on, what comes out? Light, life, and truth. And so Psalm 23 is a really easy way to start memorizing scripture. And our hope would be every household, everybody in that household would take that seriously. And we'd love to know how you're doing it. You can choose whatever way works with your brain. Some of you, it's just postcards on the dashboard of your car. Don't recommend center of the windshield. That's bad. Some of you, it's lipstick on the mirror. Fellas, I don't know what the alternative for lipstick would be, but putting it in front of you so that you see it every day, that you put it in front of you that way. And send us pictures of how you're doing it. You don't have to, but we would love to see, here's how we're doing it, or send us an email, here's what worked for our family. But our hope is that we would all memorize this. And some of you, you speak other languages. It'd be really cool if you learned it in another language, if you memorize it in another tongue. I had a woman come up to me after first hour, and she said, I teach and interpret sign language, and I've already been working on this while you were preaching. And I said, none taken, because she wasn't listening. But it's really interesting. She said, this is going to be very difficult, knowing the context of all of these words, that just to pick a word doesn't do it justice. And she finds herself really struggling in her mind. And she said, I want to send you videos of me interpreting in sign language all the nuances of this text. So I'm looking forward to that. So you've got your own ideas. We'd love to know how. You don't have to do that. But I just want to challenge you that you would look at Psalm 23 as an opportunity for your family to gather around some truths that have been celebrated and lifted up for thousands of years. Now, one of the other things, as we've been studying and talking about this in recent weeks, knowing that this series was coming, is that Psalm 23 carries some baggage with it. I did this last night just to confirm. Google funeral psalm. Guess which one comes up first? Psalm 23. I think it's because it mentions death, the shadow of death, that it's become so popular for hundreds of years to become known as a funeral psalm. I mean, that's just, you know, if you die, dude, you got to have Amazing Grace on bagpipes in Psalm 23. I don't care what else happens. You make those things happen for me, right? But as I've been studying this psalm, I've recognized that this psalm mentions death, but it's all about life. This is a psalm about living. I mean, King David wrote this about life, about today, and how I'm going to see and step into tomorrow and then 1,000 other tomorrows. This is about living. It's about life. And so one of the other hopes, I guess, is that we would recognize that Psalm 23 is a way of living, not an accepting death or a way of death. All right, so obviously we've got a whole lot of hopes for this series, and we'll have some fun along the way. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Adonai ro'i lo ekasar. The Lord is my shepherd. See, it starts right off the bat by setting a tone. And today we're just going to deal with that line. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Now, I'm going to do a mini sermon. This one's off to the side. It's not to everybody. It's going to be the world's shortest sermon. When I'm done, we'll do an invitation. We'll sing Just As I Am. We'll do the whole thing, all right? So this is only going to take a second. But David was what growing up? He's a shepherd. He's a king by the time he writes this song, but he's a shepherd growing up. Can you imagine having the audacity to call God your vocation? And so, again, this is a sidebar, and I want to speak maybe to the younger people in the room, or maybe to some of you who find yourself you've made a 90-degree turn in your adult life, and it's time to be youthful again and ask, what am I going to do with my life with regard to making a living, my vocation? I just want to, there's a whole lot of ways that I talk about this, but it's occurred to me in the last couple of weeks that maybe one of the questions we could ask is, can I call God the profession I want to step into and accurately depict him? Because if not, maybe that's the wrong job. Maybe that job won't align with the kingdom. Maybe that job won't lead to life. Maybe that job won't be redemptive. Now have this conversation, because if your view of God is narrow, it'll be hard to say, the Lord is my attorney. But I want you to know that justice is centered on the heart of God, of getting justice right. The Lord is my school teacher. The Lord is my full-time mom. The Lord is my carpenter. The Lord is my bus driver. If you can't do it, maybe you're revealing you don't understand something about God, or maybe you're revealing that this job doesn't actually point to life. It's just this thing that you've settled for. And so I want you to wrestle with that challenge. I don't want to say too much about it. We can go all kinds of directions with it. But David makes a very audacious statement about the Lord is my shepherd, because that's what he had done. All right, sermon's over. Come forward. Anybody? No? Good. All right, so the Lord is my shepherd is written by King David. All the major players in the Old Testament are shepherds. Cain and Abel. Abel is a keeper of the flocks. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they shepherd. They tend flocks. Moses, for 4 decades, tended the flocks. All the major players in Torah are shepherds of a flock. The shepherding motif isn't just one of the ideas to talk about God and people. It's the main one, over and over. And all of the leaders, including David, who writes this psalm, are literally shepherds, leading sheep for large portions of time. The question is why? Of all the occupations to point to, of all the ways of illustrating God, why the shepherd motif over and over and over? What's so useful about a shepherd? Why is this such an illustrative idea for the writers of scriptures? Why has God's Spirit inspired songs and writings and chants about the shepherd-sheep relationship? Why? Well, Psalm 95, I think, is helpful. There's a lot of passages that are helpful, but look at Psalm 95 and listen to how this is discussed. This is God speaking through the writer, and so there's this celebratory kind of feeling of, come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol or lift him with music and song. This is what we were just doing a few minutes ago. The Lord is our great God, the great king above all the other so-called gods, all the other things that people bow themselves to. But in his hand, in the Lord's hand, are the depths of the earth and the mountain peaks. Those are his. The sea is his. He made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down in worship. Let us kneel before the Lord, our maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the flock under his care. See, God being a shepherd, a creator, maker, that he's God, that all makes sense. But him being a shepherd makes a very interesting statement about him, but at the same time a statement about us. When you call him shepherd, you're making a statement about yourself. King David, the most influential person alive, within the faith at least, when David writes this, he's the king of the Jews, writes, I, King David, yes, the King David, I need cared for. I need a shepherd. I need guidance. I need love. I need patience. I need put up with. I need tolerated for all the ways that I'm completely unlike the shepherd. See, it's a statement about God. It's an illustrative statement about what God is like, but it really says a lot about us too. We're a flock, and we need a shepherd. And I know some of you right now, and I say this with respect, this isn't something I read in a magazine or, you know, preachers learn to say. This is, it was my mindset. And so I know this mindset is alive and well in this room right now. Some people, they're saying, I'm not a sheep. I didn't go to school for all those years. I didn't grow up. I didn't think as clearly as I do to be called a sheep. Weak people can be sheep, and they're probably in my row, but not me. You guys be the gullible sheeple. I am a thoughtful, intelligent person, and I don't need a shepherd. I understand that. I want you to hold on to that loosely this morning. If it's true, it shouldn't be under threat. So just hold it loosely, because I get it. I understand it. But David is making a statement as a very powerful man to say, yeah, I'm a sheep. And I need a shepherd. I need guidance. I need care. I need forgiven for all the ways I am not a shepherd. Now, shepherds were many times hired by farmers. Not every time. Sometimes shepherding was part of a family tradition, but oftentimes a farmer would hire out shepherds to take care of their sheep. And so a farm would be a way bigger, broader, more resourced entity than the shepherd. The shepherd would oftentimes be an offshoot of a farm. And so the question for me is, why not, if it's bigger, more powerful, more resourced, the Lord is my farmer? Let's go big. The Lord is my farmer. Why not? Well, it's interesting. Farms are places. Farmers work at those places. Farmers work on a farm. I know that we're brilliant like this all the time. If you're new at Crosspoint, these are the kinds of insights we feel like bless the soul. Farmers, see the word farm, if you add the er, no, never mind. Farms are places, and farmers live and work in those places. And so if you are an animal, a worker, one of the agricultural tools, you are needed more than you're wanted. You are required. I don't want to vilify if you're a farmer or you're related to one. I'm related. That's not my goal. But you are, if you're one of those things, needed by the farmer, but not necessarily wanted. You are a requirement for the farmer to do what he is doing that has only secondary benefits for the other stuff. Farming is the goal. His or her own agenda is his or her own agenda. Shepherd says something else entirely. And if I asked you, what picture of God is in your head when you think of God? What does it look like, this picture of God? What does it feel like? What emotions? Even if you're really familiar with Psalm 23, I bet shepherd isn't one of the first things in many of our minds. It's something stern. It's something up on a mountaintop. It's something hard to get to. It's something hard to get to understand and to listen. But the Lord is my shepherd is a very different picture than the Lord is my farmer, because shepherd immediately puts in mind movement. Shepherds take sheep on a journey. Farmers wait. You have to go to them, and you're only useful if you help their agenda. Shepherds have an agenda, and it's for the sheep. They follow the sheep. They lead the sheep. They take the sheep over here to this part of the pasture and say, you need to eat this vegetation because you need to have these nutrients in your diet. But stop, it's too much. And they'll travel for days to a whole other region to eat a different kind of vegetation to balance out their diet. And then it's time to go and get a drink of water. And they stay up and watch them at night. And they check them for ticks and broken legs and injuries. A shepherd can hear. Some of you, you were in 4-H. You know this is true. You can hear the sheep bleating, making its sheep sound, and you go, that's one of mine. It's on the other side of the hill, but that's one of mine, and that's one of the newborns. And yeah, she's okay. She's just loud. Or, oh, he's not okay. If he's yelling, something's wrong. And on the other side of that hill, the shepherd can yell to the sheep, and the sheep go, that's our shepherd. Other people, they can walk in. They can talk all day long. They look up. Yeah, it's one of the two-leggers. You can ignore him. The shepherd walks in. The shepherd's here. We're going to be just fine. We're going to be just... It's a symbiotic relationship rooted, like everything else when we're talking about God, in love. Now, I want you to get a sense of this because this metaphor is used to describe the relationship of religious leaders within Israel and the actual sheep. Ezekiel chapter 34, it's heavy. Ezekiel just is like, it's like a fist comes out of the Bible. Pow! It's really, really heavy stuff. And in chapter 34, God is speaking through the prophet Ezekiel using this shepherding, this illustration of shepherding a sheep. And he says, son of man, Ezekiel, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Who's the prophecy to? Religious leaders. Very important when we talk and bring our Bibles out on street corners and stuff. Prophecies are to religious people, not strangers. Prophecy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Shouldn't shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, you clothe yourselves with wool, and you slaughter the choice animals, but you don't take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, you haven't healed the sick, you haven't bound up the injured, you have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. You have misrepresented my heart, shepherds. I've given you a task of loving people and making life with me, faith in who I am, the most beautiful, the most exquisite way a human being can live. And you've turned it into another way to brutalize these people, to be selfish, to take and not give, to preach and not lift a finger to shoulder the burden. You have totally misrepresented me, the shepherd in Psalm 23. That's heavy, because once again, we're talking like we're always talking when we're talking about God, about others-centered love. Our word love, I mean, it's flaky in our culture. I love Jesus, I love my wife, I love Taco Bell. No. We're talking about others-centered, self-sacrificial, pour yourself out for others with no expectation of return. You enjoy it when you get a return, but that's not why you did it. That's the kind of love of the Bible. That's why the shepherding motif has endured from then till now, all the way into our modern era, thousands and thousands of years. It's a completely different picture than what many of us would have come to expect. There's a symbiotic relationship. There's a flow of love between the shepherd and the sheep. If it's all for the shepherd, then it just becomes selfish and brutal. If it's all for the sheep, it just spoils the sheep and makes them think the world revolves around them. It's a symbiotic relationship of love. And I'm telling you that shepherds to this day, I just read about this, shepherds will look their son in the face at 13, 14, 15 years old and say, you better find another job because you will not be inheriting the family herd. Because you do not care. You don't love them. The Lord is my shepherd is a very, very heavy, theologically, artistically heavy thing to say. Yahweh Roi, the Lord is my shepherd. Roi, my shepherd. The root word for shepherd, you'll see this word translated shepherd throughout the Old Testament, but it's the same root word as friend. And this is huge. This is this thing I think I get most excited about. And this one short phrase, a short sentence. The Lord is roi. is David, a Hebrew-speaking Jew, would have known that he was saying shepherd, but at the same time, often like is it true in Hebrew, because the words evoke pictures more than definitions, he's saying the Lord is my companion. It's translated that way throughout the Old Testament. Companion, my friend, my journey mate. The Lord is my friend. Now we're talking about the Old Testament. We're talking about the God that many of us, we look at differently than we look at the God of Jesus. But right in the center of it, what metaphor is David going to use? Companion, shepherd, friend. What kind of alarms go off in your head when you think of God as your friend? Maybe some of you would consider yourself maybe outside the faith or one of the last concentric circles out from the faith, and you hear God is my friend, and you think, well, that's cute, but who cares? So we're all going to leave here with a button. God is my friend. So who cares? That's children's stuff. God is my friend. What is that, like imaginary? How does that friendship work out? But others of you, maybe you've been in the faith for a while, and you hear God is my friend, and you don't believe it because it sounds weak. You know it's in the Bible, but you don't actually believe it. So it's true, but it's not real. Others of you, you've known that that's there, and when you're hearing me say this, you're saying, am I allowed to believe that God is my friend? Because if God is my friend, here's what many of you are thinking. That lets me off the hook. Wait. My friend? Like enforcer of law and holiness and all that other church stuff, that I get. I should be looking over the shoulder and feeling guilty for things that I've done and frankly I'm planning to do next weekend. You're saying he's my friend? See, I thought God was chasing me around with a cosmic Zippo. Like he's wanting to burn me for all the ways that I've failed some standard, failed to be. You're saying friend? Here's the thought. That lets me off the hook. I can do whatever I want. We're just friends. And I want to submit. Those are my words, but maybe you say, yeah, that is the sense. And I want to submit with respect. That's a very immature way of looking at relationships. When what we do or don't do comes from a place of trying to avoid consequences, you don't understand how heavy relationships are. Saying Yahweh Roi is far heavier than saying Yahweh is my enforcer. Can we try something? Can we experiment? You guys, you want to try some experimenting? Who's here with their friend? Yeah, I'm here with my pal, my buddy, my friend. Raise your hand. I need your help. All right, you back there. That looked sheepish. Raise your, stand up with you and your friend. Stand up. Yeah, he raised his hand. He just said, I'm not that good of a friend. I don't claim you publicly. Right. What's your name?
Gabe.
Brian. Gabe and Brian. Are there any other friends here? Raise your hand. It's all right. I'm not going to embarrass you too bad. All right. You started to, and then you said, well, we're fighting right now, so I'm not sure. Are you friends? Yes. Could you stand up for me? Gabe and Brian, and what are your names?
Amanda.
Katrin. What is it?
Katrin.
Yes. It's a very pretty name. All right, so why wouldn't you steal money from him?
He's my friend. He
because the law says you can't. That's right. Why? How much, Katrin, would I have to pay you to publicly lie about her? Name your price. You're thinking way too long, FYI.
I wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't do that? Oh, because of the commandment. You shouldn't bear false witness, right? Is that why? No. No, the reason, I know this is embarrassing, so this is all you're going to have to do. The reason they wouldn't do that, the reason they wouldn't steal money, the reason they wouldn't go key his car, the reason they wouldn't publicly slander each other, the reason you could say in a really superficial, childish way was because there's a rule. Why do I get my wife flowers?
Because it's Valentine's Day.
Oh, no, I've missed it. See, rules speak to something very base. They speak to something very childish. Love is the reason they wouldn't do that to each other. Thank you, guys. You guys can have a seat. The love is the reason that you don't do that. If you're operating on how do I avoid consequences, or will the rules prohibit that kind of behavior, you go, ooh. You don't have to have any love in your heart to just follow the rules. Relationships carry far more weight in determining how we treat each other. When David says, Yahweh Roi. The Lord is my friend, my shepherd, my companion, my journey mate. He isn't saying something light. He isn't saying something that lets us off the hook. Oh, cool, we can do whatever we want. And our friend's like, I wish you wouldn't, but what am I going to do? You're saying something that only in maturity do you understand is heavier. When my kids were younger, there were things that I couldn't let them do, and I had to be very strict and narrow with them. Frankly, from their perspective, using fear. Because who here has figured out with young children that if you get into a conversation with them, you actually lose? You have to be stern, direct, and leave out the details, or you're going to be having conversations you're not equipped to have. As the child progresses, as they get older and their heart starts to come more alive, they begin to understand the world. They begin to step into their role as a creature made in the image of love himself. Then the rules begin to wane and relational values begin to take over until hopefully that human being launches out of the house fully equipped to love and be loved. This is the story of humanity. God starting, if you go into the beginnings of the Bible, it's this narrow, it's this often fear-based, do I have your attention? This is the way you're going to live. These are the consequences. All the way to you get to Jesus, and he says, I'll tell you what the whole Bible's about. Love God, love others. And many of us, if we're not thinking, we say, well, I like the New Testament God better. The old one's mean. I want to hug this one. It's the same God, what many theologians call progressive revelation, this ability for humanity in their access to God and his spirit and learning about how life works is evolving on a social level. And God, above anyone, knows about this, treating humanity like parents treat their children. The Lord is my shepherd, my friend, my companion, my journey mate, is far weightier. Of far more significance than the Lord enforces rules. It's way heavier when you understand that we're made to love, not run from the consequences of breaking the rules. It doesn't let us off the hook. Not at all. And so I want to talk about what we mean when we say I have a relationship with God, because frankly, for a lot of people, that sounds cheesy. It's not about a religion, it's about a relationship. And you know what that sounds like to a lot of people? It's not about a religion, it's about not doing anything. It's just about where you go on Sunday. It's about some words that you stop saying and new words that nobody knows what they mean, but you say those now. It's about a relationship. And I want to tell you what you should mean, what I feel many of us do mean, is it's not about it's not about rote following the rules, trying to stay out of trouble. Well, the reason I don't steal is because I don't want to be arrested. I don't want God to be mad. To a very deep, meaningful, I am a friend of God. I want to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and I want to love others the way I want them to love me. It doesn't let you off the hook. It's far more weighty. So, to finish, what I'd like to do is finish in the book of John, the fourth book of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. If you get to Acts, you've gone too far. So if you want to open there, we're going to be in John 10. But I want you to understand the context of John 10. Because in John 9, Jesus and his followers, they're walking down the street and they run into this guy that's blind. And so Jesus does what would have first occurred to me. He spits in the dirt, makes mud, and wipes the mud on his eyes. And so everybody's going, what is this thing that he's doing? And he goes, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is a word translated means sent. Now, Jesus has already referred to himself as he that has been sent. So it's a theater parable. He's acting out a parable. Go wash in that which has been sent, and you will see when you couldn't. Oh, I get it. And the blind guy's like, yeah, I get it. You know, I can see. And so what happens is this guy washes his face, he wipes the mud off, and he can see. And so it must have just been a stunning moment for him. Well, the religious leaders, the Pharisees, the shepherds of Israel, given the task to make sure that people understood what love was all about, they can't stand this idea. How in the world did this happen? And they interview the man. They're asking him questions, and the guy shoots back. What do you want to be a disciple too? It's great sarcasm. They go back and forth. Then they go ask the parents, was this man really born blind or was this a hoax? And they're like, he's of age. Ask him. They don't really want to get into it because it says they're going to get kicked out of church if they take it too far. These Pharisees, these scribes, these leaders of Israel, the shepherds of the flock, are so determined to keep God on his farm. And only some of us get to be there, and the rest of you, you're implements for his use. You have no value. We're all doing spiritual things, and you're all nasty, dirty sinners. And they hate this idea. And the man says, I didn't see him, but I heard his voice. Sound familiar? And then he runs into Jesus and he says, well, now you're listening and seeing. It was me. And they don't get it, and I do. And that brings us into the part of the conversation where it picks up in chapter 10 of John. It says, truly, truly, I say to you, the blind man, the family, the Pharisees, everybody gathered after this event, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but he climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. These people that are swinging a leg over into the paddock where the sheep are and is trying to straighten out the sheep and try to sort through them based on some man-made rule, but in the name of God, in the name of shepherding, they're not shepherds. They're thieves. They're breaking in uninvited. That's what thieves and robbers do. From God's perspective, they're breaking in uninvited. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they'll flee from him, for they don't know the voice of strangers. Some of you are sitting here today, and you've been to church, and you've heard the message, and you've read the verses, and they've been interpreted for you, and it's a stranger's voice in your head, because somebody keeps telling you on God's behalf what's true, and it doesn't make sense, and it doesn't resonate, and it doesn't sound like the good news you're being told that it is. It's because you don't recognize a stranger's voice any more than I do. It may very well have not been the voice of God. It's been said in God's name, but it's the voice of a stranger. It's the voice of a thief or a robber. I don't know, but don't feel badly if you don't recognize the voice of a stranger. But this figure of speech Jesus used with them, and they didn't understand what he's saying to them. And I love Jesus and his patience. He gives them a metaphor, and they're scratching their heads. What's he talking about? So Jesus again said to them, okay, truly, truly, I say to you, I'm the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers. Do you know what a bold statement that is to say that on their turf? But the sheep didn't listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. He will be rescued. He will be given his life and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have preached the sermon here that the thief is the devil, that it's anti-life. The thief comes to steal and to kill and destroy. And over the summer, I kind of had an aha moment. He's not talking about the devil. Who's he talking about? He's talking about religious leaders that try to keep God on the farm. He's talking about religious leaders that can't stand the idea that God doesn't fit in their box, that he wants to befriend humanity because he recognizes love is the most powerful thing in the universe, far more powerful than keeping the rules. The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. I came, says Jesus, that they may have life and have it abundantly, have the best life you can imagine. I am the good shepherd. What's that mean? Why doesn't God or Jesus ever say, I'm God? Well, how would he say it? Everybody who said that to has Psalm 23 memorized. I am the good shepherd. And the religious leaders are going, where's my rock? Kill this dude. You can't say that. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I want you to know that I understand there are people in this room, like we talked about a few minutes ago, that they don't buy it. I'm not a sheep. That's weak. They say, I'm not a sheep. That's for weak people. I'm not gullible like that. I don't follow anybody. But oftentimes what I've found is that those people then go and read other books and go to those seminars that support that view. You know why? Bah. We're all sheep. From King David to me, to everybody in your row, the family you come from, the family you're part of, we're sheep looking for something or someone to follow. The question is, which herd? And Jesus, the good shepherd, he doesn't threaten. He invites. And so, if this sounds like a scandal, then I'm doing my job. That the God of the universe is offering you friendship. And that maybe that still sounds weak, it still sounds light, it still sounds childish. Well, I'm a businessman, I'm a professional woman, I'm supposed to go around saying God is my friend, but I want you to know there's nothing heavier that I could say to you in all my life, that you are being invited into friendship with Jesus Christ. Not into friendship with Christianity, not into, but it certainly makes you part of a herd. It's an irreligious friendship that comforts. It's a friendship that jars. It's a friendship that holds. It's a friendship that grabs you by the collar and says, how dare you forget who you are and who I am in the process? Let's go. Let's move. Let's live life together. That's what you're being invited into. Friendship with Almighty God. Our Father in heaven, help us to understand what that invitation means and the weight that it carries. Help us to be rattled to the extent that we don't, or maybe never felt until this moment, how much weight that one little phrase actually carries, especially insofar as it was written 1,000 years before Jesus walked the earth, that you have always been and always will be for us, that you love to love us, that it gives you joy to do good to us, and that you want to bring us into the best, most abundant life possible. God, we want the life, but many of us, we don't want lead. So help us to understand that what you're offering is what we're built to receive. You as the shepherd, us as the sheep, and a life lived following and trusting you for all of our life. God, I'm struck by the rest of the phrase, I shall not want. God, we have nothing to be anxious about, nothing to want, if you indeed are our friend. God, I know personally, as do many of my brothers and sisters here, know that following you doesn't mean the removal of difficulty. It's just, what am I going to want? What am I going to be anxious for? What am I going to pace the floor about if you, the creator of all things, are our shepherd and friend? Help us to understand the magnitude of what David has written.